From Spider-Man to Spawn, Mr. Todd McFarlane, next.
Now the devil, he went courting. He was looking for his queen. Fell for her near a fountain, cleansing sinner souls clean. Her beauty was seductive. Let a sanctity be damned. They could start a new religion that appealed to every man.
Baseball, art, film, literature. If you had to dump it all right now, what would you focus on?
Wow. Getting back to trying to be an athlete again, but you know, I'm over 40, so that dream is every year gets tougher and tougher. So I don't think I'm going to be playing center field for the Cincinnati Reds anytime soon. No, you know, the biggest issue I've got right now is wanting to write and direct my own movies. You know, the when I see these movies up on the screen that people are doing that are under $10 million, that are just fantastic to me, that they have to just get creative and get through it, that I'm so jealous that these people were able to do it. And they're not distracted by some of the other things that I'm doing. So they just keep sort of trying to apply the trade and getting better and better. And, I mean, there's one that just came out I saw during the summer that Haggis did, this movie called Crash. It's just,
yeah, sure. Amazing ensemble work.
It's just unbelievable. And then and on top of it, they had no budget, really.
Right.
And it was a first-time director.
And they got all these actors to sign off on it.
A skilled writer, we understand that. He'd won his Academy Award for Million Dollar Baby, but, you know, still a first-time director to give that feel and that mood up on the screen. So besides, the story was compelling. The overall look of that movie was just terrific to me, and I've been living with this idea in my head for the next Spawn movie, and I just at the point where I go, you know what, I'm just going to do it like Paul and just go, I'm going to write it and I'm going to just direct it myself, and then I'll worry about getting distribution later.
Well, you've always been a maverick, you know. Last night was very telling when you talked about just how you constructed panels and how you inked, and you took your thing, which makes you who you are, and applied it into a world that was maybe rigid. You know, it had very defined boundaries. And you said, why can't we open up those boundaries?
Well, here's the two things I find from an artist's point of view. Every artist has to find their own voice. And at the beginning of your career, you're struggling to get there. But really, when you do find your voice, it is a tip of a hat to a lot of people. I mean, everybody is influenced. You don't create in a vacuum.
Right.
Everything you see with your eyes every single day somehow is getting processed. So you may see 10, 20, 30 people that you admire, and you take like a sliver of each one of them, you put it into this big stew pot, and you stir it around and you spill it out, and you go, that's my style. And nobody's ever put those pieces in that order. So they go, oh, that's your style.
Right.
And somebody else might come along and take a piece of what I do and put it into their stew pot, and you don't sort of see it. So for me, it was the rigidity of it was to say, you know, why prevent me from just coming up with whatever is natural for me? And then the next guy, don't because I was successful, let's say doing Spider-Man or something, don't get the next kid to draw like me because it was successful, because how do you know the next kid might not come up with something none of us has thought about?
Right.
So by you saying, oh, this is a hot thing going right now, draw like this guy, to me, you go, that might be the million-dollar baby that was in front of us, and you're telling him to go at half speed. So I just, you know, to some extent, you got to rein it in because you can get neurotic artists, and I understand
right.
that when you're trying to sort of have a structured business. But just, like I said, I've lived both sides of the coin now, and I am a CEO, and I am an artist, and I understand when each one of those has to sort of come into play. And it's a delicate balance, but I think sometimes they overcompensate and think that we're just going to get too crazy artistically.
So as a CEO, and you see a young artist and he shows you his portfolio, and you know, because you've seen, you've been there, you can pick out the diamond in the rough, can't you? You can see a guy who's co-opted styles, as we're talking about, to create his own style. And you say, that guy could really work well.
Sometimes, I've got a young guy that's on the Spawn comic book right now, a guy named Philip Tan. It's a bit unfair to him that his first issue is going to be Spawn 150. A anniversary issue, double size, a lot of eyeballs on it.
Right.
And I sort of told him, go, Philip, you're going to be a little bit like what happened to me when I took over the writing on Spider-Man 1, that the most people are going to read my first job, which should technically be my worst. My worst job was seen by the most people. And so we're sort of putting you in a little bit in the same situation, which is a little daunting. I've been around the kid long enough, and I've seen his stuff, that I just go, you don't know how good. I actually sense what's in you more than you do, because young artists don't trust their instincts.
Right.
And I go, once you can get past that hurdle of you just knowing what you're capable of doing, and you can do it in a relaxed fashion, you're going to be surprised at how good that art's going to come out and how the learning curve is going to start to get steeper and steeper on you. Where right now you're thinking about it because you don't want to make a mistake. Just like all young employees, you know, they go, I don't want to get the boss upset, so I got to make sure. And by doing that, you're not as efficient as you are at any job when you're thinking about making a mistake. Just do it, and we'll worry about the mistakes later, right?
Well, you might be able to use the metaphor, since you were a ball player. You know, you have a farm system, and a manager or one of the coaches on the team says, that kid's got something. You know, we're going to nurture him. So you've created a nurturing environment. Do you think having been an athlete helps you foster that nurturing environment for your artists and your stable?
I would say that the biggest thing that being an athlete, you know, I played Pac-10 baseball. The biggest thing being an athlete was teach me how to be competitive in business. And also, and it's a big one, because my wife sometimes misses this one. She thinks I'm going to die of a heart attack. And we, every now and then, we go for medical exams, and my wife is a complete sort of health nut, and my results come back better than hers. And the reason is because I can actually go into my work mind like an athlete and go, oh, we're playing a game. I put my game face on. When I played baseball, you walk between the lines, and it was all business, and I wanted to beat the enemy at all costs. And then as soon as the last out was made, and you walked across the line, it was time to go take a shower, tomorrow's another day. I actually can do that in business now, where I can come in, I can negotiate, I can argue, I can threaten, I can get there with the lawyers, whatever we got to do, and at 5 o'clock, I can go, sorry, I got to go, and I can completely turn it off.
That was a good game, you can say.
And I'll tell you why that's actually good, because most of the people I'm playing that same sort of struggle with, can't turn it off.
Right.
They go home.
And they brood.
And they go, tomorrow when we're back in that meeting, I'm going to tell that guy. And they just sit there and they just boil. And I usually like to save those for Friday. I want them to boil for Saturday and Sunday. And by Monday, they're exhausted mentally.
And they're ready.
And I have completely turned off the switch, gone home, lived a normal life, come back on Friday, I'm ready for the game, and I'm fresh. And you just go, yeah. And so the sports has served me well in those metaphors, less so about some of the artistic stuff.
Last night you told a wonderful story about Jack Kirby. I'd like you to share that story and why, of all the pieces in this show, the retrospective at the comic book museum in New York City, that one piece was so reverential and how that happened. I just thought it really was telling on who you are and the respect that you gave the men and women that came before you in this incredible art form.
Well, anybody that does any business sort of knows who preceded them. I don't care if you're an accountant. You sort of know who the big guys are in the building or historically. Well, in our field of comic books, to me, there's really a sort of a handful of those giants, if you will. Jack Kirby, dubbed Jack King Kirby, was the Elvis Presley, the Beatles of comic books.
And it's
sort of an interesting one, because the youth sometimes doesn't pay attention to it. It's not his drawing style that I say that about, because he had some quirky sort of drawing stuff. It was the years he put in, the quality he put in, the body of work he put in, and it's a very melodramatic business, and he did it better than anybody else. I mean, his record stands up bigger and taller than anybody else. But I also used to read stories about him, how he said that the companies he thought at times would take advantage of him.
Right.
And I remember as a young kid, this was before I broke into comic book, going, wow, if they can take advantage of Jack Kirby, they can take advantage of anybody. And so it always kept my radar up. So anyway, I then break into comic books. I end up climbing the ladder of success and get on some big books. I'm doing well at Spider-Man. And then I get a phone call and somebody wants me to ink a page of Jack Kirby. And I'd met Jack off and on, and he's just a saint of a man. And I'm going, you want me to ink Jack Kirby? And I've always thought of it, because I always thought it would be cool to take Jack Kirby stuff and modernize it a little
right.
bit. But I go, I can't ink over Jack's pencils, because in our business, you take somebody's pencils, you ink on it, you then take your eraser, you erase all the pencils, you make it nice and clean. And unless I was loyal to every line, which I knew I wasn't going to be, I would be erasing Jack Kirby's pencils. And to me, as a guy who knew the significance of Jack Kirby, it'd be like erasing notes from a song that, you know, John Lennon did.
Or erasing a Rembrandt that's already been, you know.
A piece of a Rembrandt. Yeah,
yeah,
you just go, yeah. Whoa, I can't do it.
So
I did the first one on an overlay, and I sent it in, which is like a tracing paper. I did it. And they liked it so much, and Jack liked it so much, they asked me to do another one. And I went, okay. But this one, you know, the overlay didn't work quite right. I'll do it. I'll put it on a light box, and I'll trace it, and then I'll just ink that, which I did. And
right.
They went, yeah, fine. Jack can let you do whatever. I send it in. They're completely happy with it. Jack then gives me a phone call. I mean, I should be thanking Jack Kirby. These are these moments where you go,
right.
Why is he phoning me thanking me? I should be thanking him to be able to do his pages. He leaves me a message going, you young man, this is a brilliant piece, and I just want to say, you know, you really did me proud. And I'm going, oh, my gosh. A few days later, I get in the mail. I open up in the mail. He sends me back the ink page, which is with a note on there, says, you know, nice job, Todd, Jack Kirby. So now I go, wow, I got Jack Kirby's autograph. Even though I bumped into him, you never want to bug a guy for an autograph,
right, sure.
Even though you're a geek. And I'm like, oh, cool, I got Jack Kirby's autograph. And then, and again, at this point, I'm well over 30, and I'm way into my career. But he hit the geek button for me.
We all have it, man.
And then underneath it was included the penciled page that I had lightboxed. And they said, hey, Jack says he's got so many pages. You know what? If you keep this for yourself. He just wants to say thanks to you. Sent me another page. That a page that he had done that Barry Windsor Smith inked of him.
Right.
So I actually got three.
That's amazing.
And I'm just going, oh, my God. And so this penciled page of Jack Kirby to me is like, I've got a Rembrandt. I've got my little comeback. You know, I mean, I know there are some, and they're all inked. There's not too many pencil pages of Jack Kirby, but I just go, that's it. That's my prized possession.
Well, that shows your passion, too. I mean, that's an incredible story. Did you ever think that Spawn would have been so huge out of the gate that it still holds the records for the most indie comic book to ever be released?
Here's what I knew is that the comic book market was going pretty good at that point, and I was having a pretty good run on Spider-Man. So I knew that by jumping to another book, although it was going to be a character nobody knew, that the momentum of my career was still going to be able to carry a big portion of it. So think about, like, if you've got a baseball player or a basketball player, if you take Michael Jordan, he's on the Bulls, and in the middle of his career, at the height of his career, he then gets traded to the Lakers. People who are Bulls fans aren't going to go, well, he's not on the team, I don't care. They're going to be aggravated that he's not on the Bulls anymore. So there are people, I'm sure, that were aggravated that Todd's not doing Spider-Man anymore.
Right.
But they're not going to not follow your career. You're going to go, well, what's he doing now?
But you went from a big market to a very, very, very small market. That's a little bit different.
But we were able to take that momentum from the big market and catapult it into it. So a lot of the fans that were Spider-Man fans and McFarlane fans just came for the ride and go, well, I'll check out the first couple issues, I guess, see what they've got there. And so I think... And we knew that momentum was going to happen.
Right.
We just didn't know for how long we'd be able to sustain it. We're now up to almost year 15 here with the company, and we're still doing well.
Well, you know, you took the same kind of synergy and you applied it to the toy industry. You know, you raised the bar so high that for the other toy manufacturers, either you get into the domain and space you're operating, or kids are not going to get into it. And as an adult, I was a member of your early fan base where I got those deals on all those figurines. My wife kept saying, you can't wait to have kids because you got all the toys already.
No. Well, here's what I know about toys for the most part. 98% of toys are made out of clay. Clay's been around for a very, very long time if you look at the history books. Clay will go into any shape you put it.
Right.
It has no intelligence. It only will go into the shape that a human hand will put it into. I'm always amazed that people pat me on the back for doing stuff that, to me, humans should have been doing for decades, if not thousands of years sooner. So the question isn't, how did you make a dragon look so realistic? How did you make a baseball player look so realistic? How did you make a monster look so cool? The answer is, how did they not? I don't get it.
Right.
I'm looking at the same source material as they are, and they're looking at a photograph of a baseball player, and I'm looking at a photograph, and somehow they're not replicating it. I got to tell you, I don't get it. Now, God bless they don't get it, because you just did it again where you're giving me credit for doing something that to me is like...
just an obvious.
I liken it to being in a race. So think about if you're a 100-yard dash, and I'm in a race with like 8 other competitors, and they go, on your mark, get set. And just before they say go, I notice my shoelace is undone. And I go, oh my God, hold a sec, I gotta tie my shoe. Go! And I go, and I get my shoe, gotta get my shoe, and it's tied. And as soon as I stand up, the crowd's going, woo, Todd, you're in first. You're the winner, you're leading. And I'm like, what? I just tied my shoe. And I'm turning around, and I'm in the lead. And you know how come I'm in the lead? Because my other 7 competitors took a step back. That I'm in the lead is a default.
Right, yeah.
I didn't do anything, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah.
They just shot themselves in the foot and took a step back. And now you're cheering me on for being in the lead, and I have done nothing towards
right.
it. There are times that I'm there going, wow. Because I made the baseball player look like those photographs that have been around for 100 years. Somehow I'm a genius. It doesn't make any sense to me. It's like, how did they not do it? But you know what? God bless them for not doing it. So I'm like, you know what? Rule of thumb, you want to look smart, hang around a bunch of dumb people. You know? All of a sudden, you go into kindergarten class and you go, what's 12 times 12? You'd be the smartest guy in that class. So
yeah.
Luckily, for whatever reason, other companies have decided not to figure it out, and they've given me places where I go, oh my gosh, there's an opening. We can go and do it. So that's what we've been able to do with the toys.
Here's a high concept question. Why are some superheroes in the comic book industry of legacy status and others have just kind of faded from memory? Is it luck? Is it just the audience will dictate who they like?
I think it's a combo. I think it's luck. I think it's timing. I think it's what's happening in the world. I think it's the creative people you have. And I think it's sort of the mood of the audience is buying it. And I think it's the body of work. That's the one thing that I think is the most undersold is the
right.
body of work. That I keep telling artists, you don't have to be the best artist on the block, but if you do 50 issues of that comic book, they will remember you. But if you just do 2 here and 3 there, it doesn't matter. We would all love to have, you know, Rembrandt do every book, but if he can't meet a deadline, Rembrandt's no good to me
right.
on a monthly comic book.
Right.
So I have to take the guy who's his slightly less than Rembrandt. And if he can't hold the deadline, and you go down the order till you can find a guy who can hold the deadline. And sometimes those are solid journeyman artists that make career. I mean, you can't say that Kurt Swan was the greatest artist ever, but he did all those issues of Superman
right.
that we all remember. And yeah, there's artists that have come since have done flashier versions, but he did such a body of work there that you go, Kurt Swan has made his mark and has etched
himself. He defined
himself. He's in the folklore of when you talk about
right.
the history of Superman now.
Right.
Why? Was he flashy? No. Was he solid? Yes. Did he do a lot of it? Yes. And I keep telling that to the kids. You got to put out a body of work, because if you have to let the audience grab you. And if you're a rabbit or a grease pig and they can't grab you, eventually they're not going to care because they don't know where you're going to pop up next.
But it's harder and harder to do that, Todd, because, you know, we have in the music industry and all these mediums, you're judged by marketing guys now. Like, how many units did you sell? No, so maybe we're getting back to that indie spirit where if you can sustain yourself
and
create
music,
that body of work, it's hard to do it.
In the music, I would agree. And in other industries, I would agree. It's not true in comic books. It's not true.
You can exist on a different level.
If you're a solid artist and can meet a deadline, very rarely have I heard somebody just come in and fire a guy because they found somebody who's more talented. They find another room because they understand the value of a guy who can hit a deadline. Right. I have found in my 20 years in this business that the kids just don't have focus. I got to tell you, they got talent up the wazoo. They just can't be bothered to do 12 issues in a row. Where it used to be like Jack Kirby, 100 issues.
Right, of course.
Just give me 12 in a row. Let's just start at 12.
Right.
And they can't do it because they're like, oh, I want to do 5. And if I'm not a star at 5, then I'm going to jump on another book, or I want to go buy a motorcycle or something. I mean, which is okay because they're free spirits. They're artists. So you know, they got that artist mentality. And you go, okay. But for a career, if you want to make a sort of a solid career, you got to do like bulks of work.
Well, also a legacy, and that leads me to my next thing. If you're going to create a character, are there any new characters out there? Is there one in your universe that you feel has the longevity of a Spider-Man, of a Spawn, something that's evergreen that, you know, 20 years from now, people are going to say, wow, that defined Todd's career. That defined Kirby's career. That defined another artist's career.
I don't really know. I've got that guy sitting there percolating. I think that all the characters I have done right with the right effort, with the right team, with the right marketing, can actually, if you say, I'm gonna pick this character and I'm going to put him on that track and I'm going to push him down that track and I want this guy to be around for 300 issues, I think we're capable of doing a pretty good effort of any one of them. I just keep a lot of my efforts very tight and very... I keep saying to people, I go, look at... I would have been content if I had Disney to have just created Mickey Mouse and made a living off that guy.
Sure.
I didn't need Pluto and I didn't need Daffy Duck and I didn't need any of the other ones. Because if somebody gives you the copyright trademark to Superman tomorrow, you don't say, do I get Lois Lane and do I get Batman? And you take it and you run as fast as you can because Superman is a pretty big deal and you can do a lot with that one character.
Yeah.
So to me right now, the in-house stuff, if I do any sort of big focus, is usually predicated upon this character called Spawn.
So now you're crossing over into the film and the animation world again, another attempt to really let people embrace. Is there anything cutting edge in this world? I mean, the internet is so cutting edge. You can throw your work. There are no gatekeepers. You know, this is why we exist in the show. We can talk about anything. Mm-hmm. Nobody can say, oh, this is too niche. This is too subculture. Is there an appeal for you guys, for McFarlane, to get into this world with an animation thing? All this new technology makes it so affordable.
Yeah, here's the technology. You're going to do one of two things. It can do two things. It can open it up to everybody. But I got to tell you, because everybody can do it, doesn't mean everybody is qualified
or good
to do it.
Yeah.
So what you're going to end up seeing is a lot of very, very, very mediocre stuff.
Right.
And so every piece of technology is the equivalent of a pencil and paper. And I can give a pencil and a paper to my mom and tell her to draw a grizzly bear. And then she hands over that same piece of paper and that same pencil to me, and I draw a grizzly bear, and it looks different. And the reason is because I'm more qualified to use that tool, which is a pencil, than she is. Technology, to me, is no different. You can train everybody to push buttons, but if they don't artistically know how to use it in a manner that's going to be appealing to a certain crowd out there, then it's all it is technology. It's not converted then into art at that point.
But also then, having said that, because we are so bombarded with so much, you really can see the wheat from the chaff. You know, if you can get through all of the different permutations and the rivers and tributaries that are there, because, we're overloaded with so much media.
But what it does is it puts you in a position where you might not then have to pay for the A-list guys all the time because the diamond in the rough are there now.
And you can see
them. You hope you go through enough, and every now and then you find one. Even if it's once a year, once every 3 years, you find a diamond in the rough, and you hope 3 years later that diamond in the rough gets a little polished. You go, okay, that's okay.
Victor Martinez as opposed to CeCe Sabathia?
You know, I think Victor became the all-star and had the big year. He had a bit of an off year last year, not quite as good as the year before, so we're going to put him out there. He's good. I mean, obviously, since he came in the league, he's got his 13, you know, his double-digit wins every single year.
Right.
And he's good. Cleveland, the problem with Cleveland as a whole right now, I got to tell you, is that their team isn't really playing that well to create too many characters.
Sure.
Players, excuse me, and sell them on a national
level.
And
we just got rid of Coco, who I thought was one of the lifebloods of our team. How do you get rid of Coco?
Coco Crest is going to be a huge hit in Boston.
Yeah.
All the people that are lamenting about Johnny Damon.
Oh, forget it.
Give this kid 3 months,
yeah,
and you are going to fall in love with this
kid. He's a great kid.
When I heard that, I went, oh,
why do
my
they do that
God.
To us? We're long-suffering. I had to throw it in. I know people may not want to hear this Cleveland baseball story.
You know what? I have to actually get behind that curtain and talk to the business people.
Okay.
Because when you see something that doesn't quite make sense, there's usually a business reason for it.
Right.
That there's a long-term plan that somebody's put in, and
right.
sometimes when you do those long-term plan, you have to let a couple of your assets go.
Sure.
And it might be one of those situations. I live in Phoenix, and the Diamondbacks are going through
right,
sort
of course.
The same problem.
Yeah.
But they've got one hand behind their back tied, and they're trying to get both hands untied, and they have to let go of Troy Glass and a couple other guys. So, and to the fans, they don't understand it, but because I've dealt with the management there, I go, yeah, I understand what the chess game is, and
right.
it actually will be good for the health of the organization in the
right.
long run. So.
Right. I mean, we could do a whole show on sports, and we will at some point. How would you like to be remembered?
Just that a guy who died free. What is that? Nobody.
No restrictions, no handcuffs.
I died a free man. That's okay. Wasn't beholden to anybody.
Great. And what do you see for 2006-07? Where do you think you're going to impact?
I've got a couple. You know what? I'm going to start pushing more into Hollywood, and we've got some technology we're talking about that I think can bring some advancements to the toys. As much credit as we get for the toys, I still go, guys, there's still stuff we haven't even touched yet, and I think we can bring that. So I'm hoping that 06 is sort of the beginning of new directions in both of those areas for us.
Great. Todd, thanks. We'll sit down with you again in Arizona and do a little vidcast with you and get you into the Culture Catch world. Thanks
Sounds
for being
good.
On the Culture Catch.
The
devil
it.
Made a promise, I'll serve you as I bleed. Give up all my powers that fuel my heinous deeds. But the handmaid just ignored him. There was nothing more to say. She struck him down with love and left him dead to lay.
And so concludes my interview with Todd McFarlane. Today's podcast was brought to you by the fine people at Final Draft. If you've got a script to write, finaldraft.com and now Final Draft AV, the finest script writing software on the planet, finaldraft.com. And our web hosts, WebHSP. WebHSP for all of your web hosting needs. It's webhsp.com. And our new friends, DLO, Digital Lifestyle Outfitters. Check out their new docking station, soon to be released, dlo.com. This is Dusty Wright for the Culture Catch. I'll see you soon.